This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part 2 of 3 of the interview with Dr. Ting Shen, who designs the optimal statistical and machine learning models to discover hidden patterns in data at Princeton University. And he is the founder of Finding Five, a platform for behavioral research. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds, so we can pick up right where we left off in the people behind the PhDs.
Also had a practical benefit. So I was becoming pretty good at English, and I was well ahead of the standard curriculum that they were teaching school. So for all of my high school, my English teacher is also very nice. She's an extremely nice lady, and she really accommodated my special situation. And basically, for all of high school, I never did any English homework.
Wow, that is a nice benefit, isn't it?
Yeah, and I still continued to do well on exams, so the teacher never cared, never bothered me.
Oh, wow, that was nice because it actually saved you time for other subjects.
That's right, yeah.
Wow, what a cool little story. So let's now move you from kind of your last years of high school in China. And we talked earlier that there was a decision to go to the United States, and obviously we know you did that. So which schools were you considering, and in which school did you choose to do your bachelor's?
That's a great question. I actually did a little bit of research back then, because I said I wanted to study something so that I can do machine translation in the future, right? So which is something that I'm obviously not doing right now. So I connected the dots and realized, hey, I want to study cognitive psychology, cognitive science, right? So I somehow learned that cognitive science is a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary field where you can study a little bit of language, linguistics, you study a little bit of computer science, you study a little bit of psychology, then put the different, you know, expertise from different areas together, and then maybe try to work on something novel and interesting. Okay. So my strategy back then was to look at which schools had a cognitive science undergraduate program.
Oh, okay. And so from there, then you had a couple of schools you were looking at?
Yes, so I aimed really high, and stupid me. I applied to all the schools that everybody would know, right? So all the Ivy League schools, most of them did have a cognitive psychology, cognitive science program. And in the end, actually, the first round, I did not get a single acceptance. So it was a devastating experience for me. I felt like a total rejection, and I was a 17-year-old. Who was kind of really sensitive to that kind of things, right? So I really kind of was feeling down. But at the last minute, there was a college called SUNY Oswego. It's part of the State University of New York State system.
Okay.
It also has an interesting cognitive science program. And I know that not because I did my research turned up that school did not turn up from my research, but this is going to be a slightly digression, but it was recommended by a so-called agency, right? So there are agencies in China who make money off of recommending or facilitating, sometimes not in entirely legal ways, facilitating people so that they can go to United States to pursue a college career, pursue a college education. And I got to know about this particular university through an agency. Then unethical on my part, I dumped that agency directly, applied on my own. So I got into that school, and that the rest is history.
Okay, so you started at SUNY Oswego. And that's, if anyone doesn't know, that's on Lake Ontario. So that's very much upstate New York, on the water, across from Canada. That's where that's located.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very pretty.
It's very pretty. Okay. Yeah. And so in anyone who doesn't know, so New York has one of the best state school university systems in the United States, certainly, maybe in the world. It has a number of good schools, and SUNY Oswego is one of those very good schools. And so, but what I saw in your CV though, Ting, is that you actually didn't, you got your bachelor's degree from Rochester, is that correct?
Yes, so I did 2 years of college at Oswego, then I transferred to University of Rochester, which is actually close by, only an hour and a half drive away.
Yes, for anyone who doesn't know, Rochester is also in sort of upstate or central New York, however New Yorkers defined Rochester, very close to the water, very close to Lake Ontario, across the water from Canada.
Yep.
So you get your bachelor's degree from University of Rochester in New York. And what was that in machine translation? Was that in cognitive science? What was your bachelor's in?
It is still in cognitive science. The program is called Brain and Cognitive Sciences at Rochester.
Okay. Was there anything in particular that you learned that, you know, in your bachelor's degree? I mean, obviously you wanted to go there, but was there anything that surprised you or changed any of your academic direction during your time at Rochester?
I think, frankly, I don't think I knew very well, right? So looking back at it, I was mostly just going where my professors wanted me to go, because I was mostly a clueless kid.
Clueless?
But you have a PhD.
But I think what I realized throughout the college education is that machine translation is really a tough subject, right? So it's not something that you would just learn the skills and apply to it. It's not that kind of a task, right?
So it's not like becoming like a carpenter or something where you learn.
Right.
So for anyone who doesn't know, can you give people a definition of a machine translation?
Oh yeah. So for example, it's really straightforward, right? So if you give me an English sentence and a machine translation program would translate it into Spanish, Chinese, whatever language you specify.
Okay,
so
that's
what Google Translate does.
Okay, so that's a very straightforward definition. So why is it actually very complex?
Well, because language is really, so this is what I learned in my undergrad, right? So that language is actually really a complex system. Words can mean multiple things depending on how you use them, right? And there's an implication going around that's only shared between the partners in the conversation. You and I are talking like this only because we have already shared in a half an hour of conversation, right? We know what we know the basis, the common ground that we are kind of we both share. So for machines to be able to do the same thing, it's really difficult, right? So a lot of the tasks that we give the machine translators to do is really isolated and without a context. So we just throw this one individual sentence to the machine and say, hey, come up with a translation for that. That's incredibly difficult.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. So one key word you mentioned in that answer was the word implicature. And so implicature is the meaning that is suggested by words, even though the meaning doesn't necessarily derive directly from those words. So, for example, if I'm with a friend and, he sits down at a coffee. Listen, I'm at a coffee shop. My friend comes to visit me and I just say, coffee? You know, that could be a question. That could be an answer. It could mean, do you want me to get you coffee? It could mean many, many things. And so that's kind of one small example, maybe not the best example. So what you learned from the straightforward definition of machine translation, it becomes very complex because of context, and in particular, sometimes because of implicature. So even though the words say one thing, the meaning is much, much different.
Yeah.
And that's why it's hard to translate.
Yeah, that's correct. And even simpler than that, right? Sometimes I was just reading an article today, actually. So if you type in Google Translate and doing English to Chinese translation, there was a very famous sentence, I think, essentially is somebody was walking off of the roof of a house and carrying a box of shingles. And the word shingles here could either mean those shingles on your roof, or it could be the disease, right? The shingles.
Okay, yeah.
And Google Translate reliably translates this word into the disease.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or Are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Harp Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com.
Not into the meaning that refers to the disease, the condition, not the actual the shingles on the roof.
Oops.
Despite that, the word roof was already appearing in the sentence. So for a machine to be able to correctly infer all the parts of a sentence is really not a trivial task.
Okay, so let's go back to your bachelor's degree. So one big finding of your own, like these, so people don't understand when you do these studies, and especially sort of PhD, there's all this sort of personal discovery. And so your personal discovery is that machine translation is very complex. Did you decide to study something else at that point? You said you were sort of interested in cognitive science?
Yeah, so I think I wanted to study cognitive science throughout my academic career, but my interest in language itself kind of shifted later on. I was more into a more general question, which is how can people learn the statistical patterns of the environment around us, right? So this is sort of a more abstract step away from language itself. You know, you can look at language as a system of statistical patterns, right? So, but all of other things that can be statistical patterns as well. Where are houses, right, located on streets? What's the weather changes like throughout the course of a year, right? So stuff like that. Sort of my interest becomes more general and broad.
So what kind of happened, it sounds like, is that you were super fascinated in computers and language, machine translation in particular. You found that was very complex, but what it led you to is learning that language is a huge system of signal processing. So people see lots of signals, process those signals, and from that create their own heuristics and ways to see the world through what they're learning. And then you took the sample of language and you wanted to apply that to other things, which is
right.
How do people just process this world and taking whatever phenomenon underneath the world, let's say, and go through that. And that was your interest that got you into statistical thinking and learning. Was that kind of how you got to that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And thank you for summarizing it so nicely. I'm sort of more just interested into. On one hand, I sort of put myself into an even more difficult problem, right? So language is only one specific case of people acquiring, people understanding, people interpreting statistical patterns. But on the other hand, I sort of retreated from the real, the complex issues about language, but rather I put out of myself to study more abstract, more simplistic statistical patterns, right? Later my career, my academic career, sort of I was focusing on study how people can pick up changes in statistical patterns, right? So if something suddenly shifts, how do people adapt to that kind of shifts? So this is studied using artificial tasks, right? So we come up with very simple tasks and implement the aspects that we want people to adapt to. So although they are
as a control variable.
That's right. Okay. So although these kind of tasks are sort of more general than just language, but they are also much, much simpler than the complexities that language can exhibit.
So when I was doing research on you earlier, I learned that you are interested in the order of things, such as seasons. Can you talk about that and how that relates to the statistical interest you have?
Yeah, so if you think about, if you put yourself in the shoes of a caveman, right, so think about pre-civilization times, and you really need to kind of figure out the season problem, because if it's raining outside, then you better have some kind of protection, right, from getting wet. So how do human beings from the very get-go understand that throughout the course of a year, of course, the concept of the year may not even exist, right? So how do people understand that throughout the course of a period of time, there are systematic changes in the weather so that it's suddenly very hot, then it'll become cooler, then it might even snow, then it's going to warm up back again, right? So how do people conceptualize that there is a coherent time of period of time, a number of days, when it tends to be warm versus another period of time where it tends to snow, right? So I find that a kind of a conceptualization of the idea of a season fascinating, because we don't really understand astrophysics back then, right? But we still need to grapple with the consequences of the weather changes. Then how do we represent these kind of a weather changes in our head?
So how does statistical thinking help you explore that question? Because I'll just repeat what you said again. So you're a caveman or cavewoman sometime, before 10,000 years ago, let's say, maybe even before that. You're sitting in your cave, you look outside every day, some days it's colder, some days it's warmer.
Right.
So you're trying to figure out how they conceive seasons, discrete units of time where there's a pattern. Now apply statistics to this question. How do the statistics help you explore this question?
So the statistics comes into play because there are, even in the winter season, right, it's not going to be snowing every day. There are going to be breaks in the snow. Maybe someday even it got really quite a bit warmer than unseasonably warm than usual, right? So the issue is really at those kind of a statistically abnormal points in time.
One of the differences Dr. Ting is hinting at is the difference between descriptive statistics and inferential statistics. Descriptive statistics, like it sounds, describe data. If 100 people take a survey, we could say that 52 of them are female, 75 of them speak English as a first language, and 62 of them are between the ages of 18 and 49, and so on. In this case, we are describing the data. Inferential statistics, like it sounds, infers information in the data, that is, to estimate or reason results not directly given, such as the breakdown of males and females. Inferential statistics use a random sample of data taken from a population to describe and make inferences about another population. ANOVA, t-tests, chi-squared, confidence intervals, regressions are some of the methods used. This is the work Dr. Ting is interested in. For example, in the 100-person sample, if it's diverse enough, we can draw conclusions about a larger population, say, a campus of 5,000 people. Dr. Ting looks for patterns in data with the help of inferential statistics.
Am I going to believe the spring is coming just based on, 2 days of warm weather? Or am I going to continue to prepare for the winter by stocking up and possibly get some covering? Right. So there is the fascinating thing about the nature, about the environment that we live in, is that if it's full of noise, right? So if there was a pattern, even though there is a pattern, it's not going to persist every day. We're going to see a little bit of variations from time to time. Or are we going to interpret those variations and still have some kind of a stable understanding that says, I'm still in the midst of the winter, even though today is 50 degrees.
Right? So So what you're kind of going around, you're talking about probabilities,
right?
Within a season. So even though it's winter time, there are plenty of days during winter where it's sunny and actually a little bit warm, or at least temperate.
Right.
And so how do you subtract, the warm days during the middle of the winter from the cold days and understand it's still winter?
Right. So statistically, it's a trade-off. The technical term is called it's a trade-off between whether it's actually noise or signal, right? So
noise or signal, those are important concepts. Okay.
That's right. So do you is this 50 degree day just an abnormal day that's it's the only noise, or is actually a signal that's shifting a fundamental change under the hood? Now, if it's signaling a change under the hood, maybe I should adjust my belief, right? I should tell myself, oh, spring may be coming. I better start, you know, planting the seeds or whatever I need to do in the spring. But if I'm willing to treat it as just a noise, a noisy observation, a noisy event, then I better still do nothing and continue as if winter is going to last for a little while. Right?
Oh, yeah. So it's noise, signal, and then what you do with noise and signal, making a very clear choices, and that has a lot of behavioral sort of consequences.
That's right.
In this case, planting crops in the first day of spring or early in spring, as opposed to the last 2 weeks of winter, and knowing
that's right,
knowing the difference. Yep. So yep. Let's go back a little bit. This is I love this part of the conversation. Let's go back a little bit. So you did your bachelor's degree and also at Rochester University, and you also did a master's there. During your master's time, is this the kind of thing you were starting to study as the signal versus noise in statistics?
Yeah, so technically I did not, I after my bachelor's, I just went right ahead into a PhD program, right? The master's is really something they hand out to you in the middle of your career to keep you going. It's not a okay. effort to try to get a master's.
Yeah, so the technical term for a lot of people, some people will know this for sure, some people will not, it's called a terminal master's versus not. So a terminal master's is that I'm going to do a master's degree and that takes me 2 years, versus some people say I'm going to do a PhD and during the midst of your PhD, you're awarded a master's, which is what you're talking about. Okay, so now we're in your PhD at Rochester University, so you were able to stay at the same place and continue studying this. Now, for this is going to be beyond sort of my expertise, and you can sort of teach me a lot too. Were you, are you more interested in what's referred to as, it's called frequentist statistics versus Bayesian? What kind of statistics are you interested in using to learn things about the world?
Are you sure we are going to get into this?
Thanks for listening to part two of the interview with Dr. Ting Shen, who studies the order of things at Princeton University. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding.